We are in the book of Exodus today. Parashat Kisisa. It's 30 verses 11 through 34. It's the take the census one, also more commonly known as the golden calf. Because everyone remembers the golden calf story.
Yeah, Daniel, I've always wondered about the, when the Levites joined Moses and put their swords on, and then it says they went from gate to gate or something like that, and right. They killed about 3,000 people that day.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, what comes to my mind is, like, who were the ones that were killed and who made those choices? And, you know, when there's 600,000 men plus women and children, I mean, it seems like that was a pretty low number. So it's just, I'm kind of confusing if there's any, you know, discussion or Jewish thought on that.
There's a number of thoughts on that. Yeah.
Okay. And I think that's probably all I was wondering today.
That that particular topic, which I wasn't going to speak about directly today, I just right now. That's not fair. I'll talk about that in a minute because it leads into something else which I will be discussing. So I'll get to that answer. I'll give you an answer in a minute. Go ahead, Deanne.
Are the golden earrings that Aaron made them take out slave earrings?
Good question. Not likely.
Okay. My next question, may I hold that for a minute? When God said to Moses that he was going to kill everybody, was that a test for him to see because that's, his name is not to be put to nothing. So was that a test for Moses?
That, your question there is what's going to lead me into answering David's question in a minute. Okay. So both those are combined together.
Okay.
So yes, we'll get there.
Okay.
They're tied into one another on purpose.
And I just got a couple more, sorry.
That's all right, go ahead.
The 3,000 people, I automatically thought about the 3,000 that were saved in the New Testament on Shavuot?
I'm wondering
if there's something to do with that, too.
The other people have tied that together. It's possible.
Okay. I'm curious about the... When Heavenly Father made the 10 words mm-hmm. for Moses the first time, did Moses break the covenant by throwing them down? And then he made a second one? Was that like a bad act toward Heavenly Father by throwing that down like that?
That was a symbolic act.
A symbolic act?
Right.
Okay.
Hopefully we can talk about that as well.
I think that's all.
All right. Your follow-up question, David?
No, I started looking at the whole golden calf and, you know, where all this gold came from as far as making all the various items that they had to be made out of gold. And in the beginning of the Exodus, when they're pillaging, it talks about the fact that, you know, whether it was payment for slavery or whatever, they gladly gave up all these goods. And then it says that they put it on their children to wear. But then in this passage, it says that when they're making the golden calf, they take the earring, not only from the women, or one earring from the woman, but also from all the children. So it doesn't make mention of that in the previous, but it just goes to show, you know, the amount of people that were carrying gold, if it was just in loop earrings or a chain or whatever. And I think I mentioned this last time I spoke about this, but just doing the simple math, if 600,000 people were only carrying a gram of gold, you know, that's 19 tons of gold.
Yeah.
So now we're adding the women, and, you know, you can see that they just had large
amounts of
quantities of gold and jewelry.
Which is consistent with the instructions on building the tabernacle, which they'll get to eventually. They'll weigh out how much they use, a lot of it. There's an enormous amount of metal being used there, from silver to copper and gold and wood and fabric. Lots of stuff being used, a lot of it. A lot of donations, things of that nature. they got all the stuff from Egypt. Egypt was pillaged. I mean, truly pillaged. And mind you, Egypt at the time when they left was the biggest power on earth. Had the most amount of money, most everything.
Carts or anything, does it?
Carts?
I know that there's some mention of donkey and...
When they packed their stuff and left Egypt, I don't recall... I don't look at it again. I don't recall if it mentions carts at that time when they're packing their things up to leave. I don't recall.
It's hard off to believe that they quite likely
had carts. They
have
a lot of animals. And, there's a good chance they had carts too, but I don't recall if it specifically
mentions
carts.
It was in the book of Cecil DeMille.
Cecil DeMille, yeah. He did two movies. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So they probably had carts as well, because they're used. They're actually mentioned later on. As far as the gathering stuff that the tribes are doing, they have lots of carts full of this gold and silver that they're delivering. There's a lot of it. Okay. Oh, yes, go ahead, Pat.
Aaron's the one that made the golden calf, and yet he said, you know, he blamed the people for it. Why did he continue being the high priest?
Good question. Shouldn't that disqualify him? He's obviously, he did minister to the people. Let's see here. Stress. I will talk about that in a minute when Moses used the term exposed in verse 25 and such. The word exposed there gives you the key as to why Aaron is still selected as the high priest. All right, let's go through some of this. A few details want to grab your attention. I intend to answer these questions. These questions are part of my spiel today. As we begin, it says, take a census. As it points, it describes the census in verse 11 to 16, discuss the census details. It may seem strange to us in modern day world as far as why would God require an atonement for being counted? Right, what's the big deal, right? So you got counted, take a census of all the people, but if you don't get atoned for your responsibility for being counted, you may receive a plague against you. God may strike you for it. I asked my children this last night, because it's a complex issue. It's not easily answered in our modern day world, because we take counts of censuses all the time. Every 10 years, the federal government does it. The local governments do it more frequently for different what they're having measuring. A census. What's the big deal about a census? Well, that's an interesting thing. We'll discuss census a little bit. In the examples, we're not given many examples of censuses being taken. The Torah gives us two. God commands census initially, and he also counts again for the firstborns, so to divvy up Levi being exchanged for firstborns of all the sons later on in the book of Numbers. We have census being taken, and also for divvying up the land, how we divide who inherits what section and what cities, that kind of thing. So censuses are used, and God commanded both of those to be done. So the census was valuable, he even commanded it, but yet, to be counted, you must atone for the fact that you were counted by the half shekel. You must pay for the fact you were counted. Now, David comes along many, many years later, and he has a census taken. And Joab, his commander, says, don't do it. This is not a good thing, it's not going to end well. You don't want a census, you don't want a census taken. Now, Joab has his own problems and gets killed later for his things, his mistakes. But he's trying to help David not get into this problem. But, as the book of Kings tells us, David had, as it says, the Lord or the Satan put into his heart to take the census because God had a grievance against the people. And so this was the reason David used the census and counted the people. I forgot the number it was to make a difference. And as a result, God gave him three options. You know, the enemies, the for 3 months, and I forgot the three. There were three different choices. And David chose being the hand of living God for 3 days. So for 3 days, a plague was sweeping through the people, all whacking, killing them all off. I don't know how many died, a whole bunch of them died. And then the angel, as he approaches Jerusalem, where David's hanging out, he stops. His sword's drawn, standing there, and David sees the angel in the heavens. He sees him standing there. And David runs out with his men. This angel's about to enter the city, just standing there waiting, not saying anything, just waiting. Because he knows the city of Jerusalem's next. And the 3 days, this is the ending of the 3 days. It's about time. And so as the story goes on, David runs to the spot where the angel's standing there waiting. The angel's not crossed the spot, just waiting for his sword. Not doing it, just waiting. And David sees, I forgot the gentleman's name, but a man who owned the property. He was doing some, it was a wine press. It was a wine press or threshing floor. I can't remember what it was. Threshing. So David purchased the cattle he had and the ox cart he had, burned up a sacrifice, an offering in front of this big angel. And the angel sheathes the sword and leaves and doesn't attack the city of Jerusalem. This is the process that's how we got into the story. The census brought us into that part of the story. And of course, that spot, David says, I'm building the temple here, this location. Because the angel stopped and waited here. The whole time the angel waited, he was waiting here for David to do his process, to make atonement for the people. Because when you're counted, an atonement must be made. And what was David's solution for the atonement? Right there, after all the people were dead, sacrifice the animals to pay God or make an atonement for their sins. Now, David wasn't high priest, but he still did the job. The job had to be done. And so he did it. So the census is an interesting problem. So the census is we have to get this half shekel is paid. Now, there's lots. No, this is men in particular. This is 20 years and up of males. If they're fighting males, fighting ages. David's objective when he accounted was to find how big of an army he could produce. He's not going to count women for that. He's not going to count children for that. He'll do 20 years up. He's not going to count the elderly people who are crippled either. They're not going to count either because they're not going to fight. So he has there's an age group which is the census is counted. Now, God does not specify the maximum limit, just a minimum, 20 years and up. He doesn't say a maximum. You could be 1,000 years old. He didn't care. Just count them all. David would have had a limit on that max. It wouldn't do any good for the old people. But his was a government. His objective was to measure for military strength. What's God's objective? Why is he counting the census? No, not yet. The dead firstborn are counted a little bit later. We'll discuss that as far as how that's done. This is part of it, though. What do you think? Why does God count the census?
Because he said the day that the sand of the shores are counted, and the depths of the seas, you know how depth it is, that day I'm going to forget. I'm going to forget about you. I'm not going to love you anymore. I'm talking to the people of Israel. So he said to Abraham, if you can count the stars, then right, that's your descendants going to be. So when you start counting the descendants, that is so much.
You try to count the
then
stars.
it's like you're telling God, there isn't really very many people, so we can count them. So your promise is not really what you said.
That's for men, why men count, that is a true statement. God has specified to Abraham that your descendants will be the stars of heaven or the sand of the seashore, uncountable, right? When you're counting, what are you doing? You're testing God. You're challenging him. God, did you do it? Am I really that big? Did we actually accomplish this? And what's God saying? You're paying for that. Don't test me on this. Don't test me. Don't challenge me. I make them as many as they're going to be. You don't need to know the number. They are to remain uncountable. So when men do censuses, we ask for military strength. Or in our modern day representatives to delineate the representative boundaries of who represents what for different districts and such, same thing, the number of people to divvy all up for representation. The idea is for government use, to count how many people is in your contingency. How many people do you represent? How many people are you defending? Well, I'm doing this many, and you're defining a particular group, and you are making a challenge on God's count. And what was God's stipulation? If you can count the stars. How can you count the stars, by the way? No. They can barely estimate the number of galaxies. The star counting is just beyond comprehension. They just throw out random numbers, a bunch of zeros at the end. So it could be this. Two more zeros, no one notices. You can't really count them. Can you count the sands and seashore? Same problem. Well, I'll count this little square inch. I'll say, well, it's about 4 miles that way, 8 miles. Okay, it's about this much. You really don't know. It's just guessing. That's the idea. Don't bother counting. It's not worth the effort. So when men count censuses, we are testing or measuring God's strength. Because God said, I will make you as big, as innumerable. I am testing, are you actually as big as you were supposed to be. So you're challenging God. And God says you will have shekel payment when you do count as a payment for the fact that you're testing me. The people themselves are the ones who are paying it. Why doesn't the census taker pay it? Aren't they the ones? Why doesn't the census taker pay the fee? No pun intended. If David did the counting of the census taking, shouldn't he be the one who pays the price? Right? He's the one who did it, right? What's God specify, though? It's the half shekel comes from the individuals being counted, not David himself. They all have to pay. When they take a census, you take the shekel, they have to pay it, but they didn't pay it. So what did they pay? With their lives. They died. D-I-E? Oh, whatever. They die. David knew to pay it. And David would have told them the counting process. They already knew how to pay it. And the high priest knew how to pay it. Everybody knew how to pay it because David studied the Torah really, really well. He wasn't a master, but he knew it really well. Read the Psalms, you realize he knew this Torah really, really well. He mastered it good enough. So he knew what was going to happen. And he decided to do this. And it points out that God had a grievance against the people, which is the facilitating this counting was a straw that God used. Say, now I'm going to. Now, why would God have a grievance against the people? Why would he have a grievance against his people during David's time? What were they doing? What was so awful? He would say, I have to kill a whole bunch of you. When God had a grievance against the people during David's time, why did he have David count them as the straw, so to speak, that broke the camel's back in order to make and kill off a whole bunch of people of Israel? What things could these people have been doing or done to justify God's actions against them? Don't know? There's quite a long list, a laundry list of things that they've been doing. Yeah, they have their temples, they have their gods, and all these things they're not supposed to do, and they're doing all of them continuously. And David, as he specifies to his son, I'm not strong enough to stop these things and do everything to fix it correctly. I'm not powerful enough. Solomon, you must take care of it. Of course, Solomon screws up this backwards. But the idea was that Solomon was supposed to fix it because David didn't feel he was powerful enough to force the people to obey one and only one God. Well, if he's what started to do it, who is? God himself is. So what does God do? I have a grievance against you. And this is my grievance. And he goes off and he kills a large number of them. And what, which we learn, Moses does the exact same thing in our Torah portion we just read. The exact same thing. He has a grievance. And what's God's grievance? They worship another god. They worship a calf. What's Moses say? Don't kill him off, God. I'll do it. Essentially. I'll take care of it. And Moses goes down and kills 3,000 people. So Moses is acting out similarly to how David was acting out, though Moses knew what was going to happen, and David didn't, until afterward. But they still act the same thing, a grievance against a people that God said, I'm going to destroy what they just did. They did it as incompatible with life. You're worshiping another god in my presence. Yes.
I'd never really thought about it before until just now. And, you know, just in the same way that Eve was helping to deceive Adam into lawlessness. I mean, so we see it happen over and over again in their future, you know, with taking on these women from these tribes that they're supposed to kill. And then they intermarry them. Then they lead them astray to their gods. And they follow along blindly back into lawlessness.
Yep. It's a never-ending cycle, so to speak, and continuous testing all the time. Well, that's an important thing to learn from testing. So we learn that censuses and census taking, it's a testing process of God. We're testing how big are we? How did God fulfill what he was supposed to do? Did he accomplish what he said he would do? And if we're going to count ourselves, you pay for being counted. Now the term half, the Hebrew word for half means life and death. It's a funny word. It's to choose. It's a strange word. What's the right word? I wrote that dead word down here, somewhere on here. No, not shekel. The word half. The word half. The word half. I forgot the word. Anyway, it's a mixture of life, death, and being stuck in the middle. chai. Yeah, and then it's a mem and tet tav. And then it's zaydi in the middle. So you have chai, life, and death. Met and chai, and stuck in the middle is the zitzit in the middle. It's the Hebrew word for half. The idea is that the half is the deciding point. Will you live or will you die? That's your halfway part, your halfway mark of your life. Will you live or will you die? So the idea when they say half shekel, they break it up, the matzit, it's the idea of half shekels. The shekel is the sanctuary, the measure which God weighs in the balance of the scales. That's the idea of it. It's a scaled weight. It's this much gold worth this many 20 gerah, I think it says, for a shekel. So it's a weighing scale. And the halfway mark is, does the scale tip for you or a scale tip against you? That's the idea of the half shekel. You're weighing the scale, the shekel, and the half is, it's either the half, because you have 50-50 shot, either for or against. They're for or against you. So the day of the half shekel is God's going to approve the counting or disapprove the counting. Will you live through the process? Will you not live through the process? Are you found wanting or are you strong and doing what is righteous? It's the idea of being coming to an account for your actions and your value. That's the idea of the concept of half shekel. Live and die based on the shekel weight of measure. So it's a scale. That's the concept behind it. So that's where hence the half shekel came from. Let's move forward. There's more stuff going on here that I want to talk about before I get into it. Oh, yes, go ahead.
I went to the temple last night. You know, the one down...
Yeah, down the street.
Yeah, down at the bottom of... down there. Anyway, the sermon last night was on this. And... lost my place. Was on marijuana. And the reason it was on marijuana... that a bunch of rabbis had gotten together and had a big controversy as to whether marijuana was kosher. And it centered around on a 30 verse 22, 24, 500 shekels of cassia.
Yes.
And they said that cassia was marijuana. And the question was, is marijuana kosher? And formally, marijuana is kosher.
It is.
Because
it grows commonly in Israel.
It's not animals. It's a seed-bearing plant. It's therefore kosher.
Right.
No question about it. The question is, how are you going to use it? And so that becomes the question. And and that's the big question open to interpretation. But the big question was answered, marijuana is kosher.
That's good to know.
But yeah, it started with this 500 shekels of cassia.
Uh-huh.
Cassia evidently has something to do with marijuana.
In Hebrew, we have different words for things. So modern day English, you use the word cassia, refers to a type of cinnamon base. It's a base plant, like a cinnamon. However, in Hebrew, this plant, what we call marijuana in our country, our culture, our nation, it is a common weed in the Middle East. Common weed. It's all over the place. It doesn't smell that great, but it's very common. It's not the drug that we've manipulated to be here. It's a common weed that's just grown there as just a plant. I still call it weed for other reasons. So when God's going to use different plants, for his instance, what he was using, he's going to use what's readily available and what can be purchased. Not what cannot have to be imported from across the world, from other countries. So it is cassia, the Hebrew word, not the cinnamon word that we think of cassia as a type of cinnamon, that is a variety or a species related to our marijuana plants. Yes? I'm sure they would.
Well, I mean, it's severely mitigating that interpretation would be the fact that no... intoxicating substances were allowed inside the temple whatsoever,
yeah, you can't
neither
use
by the priesthood
like
or anything. So
right.
if it was some sort of relative, it would be like hemp. It would have pretty much the THC would be nil
gone,
to none.
Virtually nothing. Right. Yeah. Because it's a wild plant. Because hemp grows wild, it doesn't have any of that chemical in it. So it's not like a psychedelic drug or any kind of use that you can't use in that way. The goal, however, was smoke creation. To make a smoky feel, to make it look very smoky inside. Now, there's a lot of ways you can do that. Burn a lot of different green type of plants will cause smoke, not as well. This is a plant that would, there's relatively dry climate available, but when you burned it, it'd make a very smoky appearance because you don't want to see, use the term loosely, God's presence. So they want something that smokes. And then everything else is just the scent, the smell. So it's not like it's a base of a fragrance they're looking for or even the smoking high you get off a pot. But it's the smoke cover, the shield, the screen it produces, which is, it does produce a, well, a natural plant does produce a heavy amount of smoke that it produces. I won't say what the rabbis thought on that one. Go ahead.
Yeah, somehow I don't think the hemp, if they were using hemp for this smoke, they needed all that other stuff to mask the stench of that hemp, because the hemp might be really good for creating a lot of smoke, but it is not a pleasant smell.
It smells bad.
So all those other things would have to mask the unpleasantness of whatever hemp.
That is true.
Hemp
is not a very pleasant smell.
Using.
Yeah. Anyway.
A very well...
It's reasonable.
Research.
Yeah.
And in here, they don't use the word cassia.
Mm-hmm.
They just use the word cinnamon.
Right. Well, there's two different forms of cinnamon. They have, where is it? Verse 22 at list, sorry, 23 is off the myrrh fragrant cinnamon. And then 24 says of 500 of cassia and the sacred shekel of weight. So the two different words being used there, one's been a cinnamon, one's been a cassia. There's 22 verse 24. Two different words. But it's not that it really matters. The objective of the plant, now, I'm not saying it's the hemp plant we have. It's a relative of it because it grows wild in a very dry climate. Our hemp plants don't grow well in super dry climates. You have to have a lot of water for them. They don't have a lot of water there. It's a very dry plant, very oily plant in that form of dryness. So it puts a lot of smoke, which was the goal. I don't know how bad it stinks. You can still go there and still harvest it. It's still available. It probably stinks as bad as hemp does here. It smells awful. But that's just my personal opinion when it's selling.
I'll sign up for veggies.
That's potluck, yeah. Okay, let's go back to our story before we go too far off here. Too late. That's all right. It's funny. It's a funny sidebar. So I made these incense and various things which they would produce for the oil, for anointing, for base oil, as well as for incense and various things that they would burn. I'm going to go through all the various details of the incense. They're mixed various configurations and for different purposes. The idea of being holy means set aside. It means it has a particular purpose. Set aside for this purpose. Don't use it for your own personal use, your own fragrance, whatever. Now, have people done that? Of course. We're humans. We do it all the time. We do everything against God. He says, don't do this. We'll go do it just because he said so. But that's what people do. So there's a lot of people who have made this formulation. Point is, just don't use it. It's not that hard. Just avoid using it. God said, hey, I set aside. Leave it set aside. Don't use these formulas. Yes, you can make them. It's physically possible, but just don't do it. Bless you. Let's move on. So look at the details of all the various mixtures. And they'll discuss more about their mixing later on when they actually physically make it. It's God's still description. Let's jump on. Chapter 31. He has weavers and various people, the goldsmiths. He rattles off two people who are in charge. He assigns them or designates them for this purpose. In these uses, those of you who know what artists are like and or you are an artist, there is a tendency of those of us who create because we enjoy creating to not stop creating because we're really enjoying it. From making an art form, writing, drawing a picture, or creating a sculpt, makes a difference. We are enjoying so much we don't realize the passage of time or the fact that it's Shabbat. But God, He rests the seventh day, He defines creation as work. Because He created the day one, He created day two, He defines creating something is working. That's what we're discussing. I asked this question with my children. grading in his work. So creation is that he wants you to rest from. So if you're an artist, these two people are artists, refers to, they're actually in charge of a group of artists. There are artisans, they're gold makers, a lot of things they grade and create for attractive and beauty, which is fine, that's good. He's pointing out, on Shabbat, make sure your artists put their tools down and go rest, even though it's Shabbat, because our human nature is, but I'm really enjoying this. I really like making what I'm making. He's pointing out, hey, I'm inserting this reminder of Shabbat right in the middle of this artist's description of what you're going to make. So remember, don't forget to rest. You have to rest too. Creating is still a work form. Yes.
Well, it's like in this time, very few people get the luxury of getting to be an artist in life. So their art, they have day jobs. Artists have to have day jobs because art doesn't,
doesn't pay by itself.
Sustain them. So it's like, well, if they get their weekend to like do some art, I don't know. I think that I get what you're saying too, but it's just like impossible because I'm an artist too, and it's like, well,
it's hard.
The rest of the week. So.
It's hard. Yeah, you get exhausted. You want to enjoy yourself. I'm going to discuss a few things about the idea of what work is, and we'll discuss what that means. I did ask my children this last night, and they had a hard time with it at first, but after a while, wait, my other marker go. Oh, here it is. Now, work is defined pretty simply. Now, this is a simple definition. It is a work of what you are doing for a living or for a livelihood or a functionality of whatever you're assigned to do. So, work. I'm bringing this up because Messiah brought it up, and it meant something to his day, and it means something to us, too, because it's important to understand the distinction we're doing here. Work. In rabbinical literature, they define work in a basically two ways, but they're both heavily related to each other. So the most common way is create. Now, create can mean a lot of ways of creating. Either you're fashioning something, you're building something, you're producing something, you're creating something, whatever it is. They also allow you, creation is also a form of reorganization or rearrangement. It's also a factor or form of creation. So creation or arrangement. Yeah, like cleaning. No cleaning on Shabbat. That's basically broken up. Now, when we discuss work, well, we generally, people are paid for doing whatever they're doing. So you get a fee or something you're gaining out of it. But also God discusses here, which we learn more about Shabbat, about cooking, collecting sticks, starting fires. All of those categories he falls into things you don't do on a Shabbat. There are days or times set aside which you will do that, the times set which you will not do that. Now, I have a question for you then. What is work that doesn't fall into a prohibited category? Yes.
Like what Deborah's doing today, ministering to a sick little old lady.
How?
Because on Shabbat, Messiah
helped many people.
A man with withered hand, and he looked at the scribes and Pharisees and said, "Is it a sin to do good or bad on Shabbat?"
Right.
And then they shut their mouths and watched him, and he said, "Stretch out your hand," and he touched him and healed them.
Mm-hmm. So we have a category which we learn now. At the time of Messiah, helping was not accepted work on Shabbat. Modern day Judaism, of course it's accepted work on a Shabbat. They expect you to. That's your job. So they learned, not just from him, but from other rabbis that followed him too, that taught the same thing. Say, hey, guys, work is work, but helping somebody is not classified as work. So you are assigned or assumed you will help someone when they are in need of help, regardless of what day of the week it lands on. So he taught that lesson, but many others followed his suit and followed even modern day the same lesson. Now, not everybody does, but many do. Yes.
Wouldn't you have to classify that a little bit more? You're not
going to
help them building
their house. Yeah, that's what we're about to help. Yeah. What does this group of helping mean? What does it mean? Life. Now, so in the form of help, a lot of things I can help someone with. For example, I'm standing up here today and I'm spitting out words at you. The idea is I am creating or giving you something. I'm working up here doing something. Well, Is that work? Yes, it is. I'll testify. It is work. And actually, it's a lot of work. Just saying. It's a lot of work. But what am I trying to do? Am I creating something? Not exactly. Am I arranging something? No, not really. Am I helping you? Well, sort of. We'll discuss what that means. Go ahead, Pat.
The priestly function was allowed on the Sabbath. And
right.
Kind of what you guys do would be similar to the priestly function in that you're ministering to the congregation.
Because you're telling them to do something, whatever that may be. What was the priestly function's primary task? They were the representatives between man and God. That was their primary task, to be the representative. You couldn't go directly to God. God even tells that in a Torah portion, if I'm near you, I'm going to perish. You're going to die because you guys are perpetually doing something screwy. So you're not going to survive me. But the priest is supposed to be the mediator between. Priest stands here, so okay, what do you need? Okay, I'll go talk to God. Okay, we go back and forth as the mediator between. So his job is to always mediate between the person and God himself. That was the idea. So when he's helping someone, whether it's a Shabbat or a holy day or any other day of the week, what's he doing? He's serving them. He's serving them in some capacity. Now here's a capacity which Larry just pointed out. Watch what you're serving. So let's say, for example, as Larry just gave the example, I can help someone physically, or spiritually. Give me an example of a physical help. Any ideas? A doctor. That's a doctor. That's physical help. A doctor. Yeah, a chasm, a ditch or something. So he fell in a ditch, right? Now, give me an example of spiritually. What was that? Discernment. I have no idea to spell it. Discern. I'm going to guess. D-I-S-C? Okay. Oh, whatever. It's close enough. Terrible spelling. Thanks a lot. In examples of a spiritual help.
Teaching would fall into that category.
Teaching?
And ministering to them.
Ministering is a form of service. Ministering them in what way?
Helping them if they're, you know, guiding them, giving them some wisdom and guidance,
teacher guidance.
In an area that they need help in.
Circumcision.
Circumcision's included too. Now, first circumcision, however, is a physical one and a spiritual one. Because, yeah, it's right in the middle. I'll put that little dashed line, because circumcision is included there, too. I can't spell circumcision. I'll abbreviate. I can't spell that word. Circumcise. It's in between. Here's what I want to discuss with these details. In Judaism, when they define work, and you're not sure what category it falls into. This is a fair definition. They divide it up to gain or not gain. Now, the work, it doesn't say money. It's gain versus not gain. All right, they divide this way on purpose. This is not by accident. So we divide work when it forms to creating, arranging, or even helping, because some of these helps are part of your daily occupation, right? You're paid for it. Some of these helps are not your daily occupation. You're not paid for it. But how do you divide them up? If I am a doctor by occupation, that's my occupation, I'm paid to do doctor work, and somebody comes in on Shabbat, my office, whatever, I broke my leg, oh no, set it for me. Okay, I'll set it for you, here's the supplies, whatever I'm going to do, I'm not a doctor. Pretend I was. Make a lot more money then. Wrap it all up, fix his leg, whatever it may be. Well, that's my job. I'm paid for that service. The supplies have to be replaced. Am I doing it for free? No, I'm not. I'm being paid for it. This is part of my job. That's why he came to me. If I was doing it for free, it goes to somebody else. I wouldn't be very good at my job. So a doctor may be paid for what they're doing, because that's their daily job. Well, that's still part of helping. It's physically, but he may or may not charge that day. We do not know. Depends what the task would be. If emergency surgery that costs thousands of dollars worth of equipment to do, he doesn't charge you a day, he's broke the next day, he's out of business. So he have problems, which depends what's going on. So how do we deal with this? That's why Judaism breaks up into the form of gain versus not gain. What are you gaining and who is gaining? If you yourself are gaining something, that's your work. If you are helping somebody else gain something, you are helping them work. Both are prohibited because both are gain. Now, they don't say what gain is, just gain. I'll discuss what gain they're referring to in a minute. So when you say, okay, when we break something up into gain, Shabbat is not about acquiring anything. It's not about acquiring goods, not about acquiring services, it's not about acquiring anything in this life at all. What's Shabbat about? As Messiah points out, where do you put your treasures? Is it rest and your treasures just be acquiring up there, right? So if I'm going to gain something, what gain is acceptable? Treasures up there are acceptable. Because that is not a Shabbat rest up in heaven. It's a stored up gaining location. You can continue to gain treasures in heaven is fine. Gaining treasures on earth isn't. So whether we're personally gaining treasure or helping somebody else gain treasure, maybe I'm a volunteer at a soup kitchen and somebody else is making money off it. Who knows? The point is, volunteering to help somebody else who's gaining is still working. You're not the one who's gaining from it, but they are. You're helping them work. That's part of work prohibited action. Since God said, your maidservant rests, your manservant rests, your ox rests, everything rests, you don't gain either. That's the idea when we come into the game. So when dealing with gain, that's how we break it apart. So in gain, I can gain physical gain, which is here, or I can gain spiritual gain here. This example here, which was given earlier, teaching or guidance, is that a physical gain or a spiritual gain? Are you gaining it, though? Yep, you are. Ideally, that's the whole point. You want to gain understanding, gain discernment, gain wisdom, using a value to gain things up in heaven. That's your goal. The treasures in heaven is what you're after. So Messiah was relieving people of their physical ailments. What was he doing at the same time? During Shabbat, and was he doing a physical healing? Yes. Was he doing a spiritual one too? Absolutely. The people then got relief from their misery. And that relief, they jumped for joy and they shout out and praise God's name for what he'd done. What have they just done? They just gained spiritual discernment that, wow, this guy is like God. That's discernment. They learned something. So what's he teaching them? He's teaching them just like everybody else teaches, but he's teaching them specific things. Spiritual aspects, spiritual things, spiritual tasks. What were the priests doing when they served on a Shabbat? They're helping with their spiritual problems. Their sins, transgressions, iniquities. Their offerings must do. The circumcision that comes along with it. The priest's job is to assist the people in their spiritual needs. They have physical needs too? Yes, they do. What if someone has leprosy? He's supposed to inspect it. All right, well, do you have leprosy? Oh, go off in the camp. Or no, your leprosy's healed. He has his jobs as well associated with it. They're all based, so they're physically helping someone. They're spiritually based. The idea is being in the spiritual concept for Shabbats in particular. Does that make sense? So dealing with what we're working on, what we're doing, who's gaining and what is being gained? Is it wisdom with God? Is it understanding and spiritual knowledge? Or is it just my personal use of knowledge, learning how to fix my car, learning how to invest properly, learning how to, those are not spiritual gains at all. They're physical gains of knowledge, but they're still gains. Does that make sense? Distinguish between the two of them. That's how it is typically done. Now, you may disagree with it, but that's how it's done. Let's move forward. So Shabbat's important. Don't forget Shabbat. Don't break the Shabbat. Now, in the midst of all this writing down Moses doing, they have a golden calf problem. So Moses delayed in the descending of his work, or coming down from the mountain. Maybe they didn't delay, it's 40 days. Well, great, 40 days is a long time, to be wrong. No food and water, you probably wouldn't live long. But it's Moses and God, so they live a long time. So Moses up in the mountain for 40 days, roughly. The people, we don't know what happened to him, he's gone, who knows. Let's build a calf. Actually, let's build gods, plural. Get this attention to us all. Oh, yes, Jared.
It said he delayed in coming down. He said 40 days. You'd think you'd remember, oh, I have to be down there in 40 days. What happened?
What's the delay? Well, I couldn't say he actually truly delayed. I think they just kind of have temporary knowledge of, they forget quickly. So gone for 40 days. They asked something very specific of Aaron. Now, Aaron rephrases this differently when he talks to Moses. They asked him very specific of him. Make us gods, plural, that they will go before us. We don't know what's happened to Moses. Now, mind you, the people came out of Egypt. They have a particular Egyptian slant on the definition of what a god is and god isn't. All right? So, gods. Oh. Yes, in chapter 32. Egyptian. Egyptian god form concept is not that much different, though it is, does have some differences, from the Japanese Shinto religion of the every object that you see has a god in charge of it. So, for example, there's a god in charge of the rocks. Every rock has some element of that spirit god in charge of the rock, right? Well, the same thing with a tree or water. That's where we get the Pokemon from. The Pokemon cartoon shows, that's what it's the Shinto religion, that every object has a spirit in charge of it. That's the multiple religions, multiple god religion. So that's where Pokemon comes from. That's Egyptian religion too. So objects have a spirit or god. I'll use the term god respect for some people, lowercase. in charge of it, that can be responsible for, can use it at their whim or at their instruction, depending on the greater god that controls them. Well, that's a tradition. The Israelites came out of Egypt, right? So remember, they have this basic understanding of what Egyptian religion is and what that god system means. There, see it better. They also have a Trinitarian god, which Egypt created, the Trinity philosophy, which they imparted to many other generations. But this philosophy was in its infancy when the Israelites were coming out. They were still developing that. So the philosophy of Trinity was a little bit later, meaning about 100, 150 years after they left, the Trinity started to show up. There were three main gods in charge of all these object gods. So this is the philosophy that Israelites come out of, that objects have gods associated with them. Now, imagine yourself an Israelite. You just came out of Egypt. You have this philosophy. What does the world look like to you? Well, you see this big pillar of cloud that moves around. Now, do clouds normally move around at a whim? No, they usually drift. They go by, maybe they have rain, maybe not. But this one's moving around. It would reinforce your philosophy, there's a spirit in charge of this cloud. Now, this spirit has this pillar of fire. It does the same thing, it moves around. Does fire normally do that? No. But it reinforced your philosophy of this. Now, later on, we'll learn the same thing about the whole rock being split open. Water comes out. Oh, look! The water gushes out. Clearly, there's a spirit in charge of the rock. So, they have many things. Objects have a spirit assigned to them, and you may need to worship or honor those individual objects, just like the Egyptians taught them all to do. So, when they come along and say, Aaron, make us gods, they're actually literally want many gods, the ones that will be in charge of various tasks. The various things they have to do, because Moses was doing all this stuff, and he's gone, so we have lots of gods to replace them with. That's the idea, what they're instructing him. Now, Aaron creates, obviously, one in particular. This is a golden calf. So he gathers all their gold to make these golden objects, these objects into a god in the form of a calf. Which, again, reinforces their philosophy that every object has a god associated with it. This is Egyptian philosophy. It's not uncommon. The world of their day is very common. They have spirits in charge of everything, right? Just ask the spirit of this thing or that thing and that thing, and it'll do it for you. The calf philosophy, that's what we're getting into next. Why was it a calf? What was going on with the calf? Now, I don't have a picture off the top of my head. But anyway, in the Middle Eastern culture at this time and the next, like, 300-400 years, or about, I don't belong with that, a long period, chunk of time, many, many years, many generations. Each city or town had its own god. So if I had a god that was the god of Tyre.
See that white Tyre guy?
Wrong Tyre. Michelin man. No. The god of Tyre, and there's a god of, a rough map, Sidon. And there's a god of Hasharet. Anyway, A-T-H, oh, whatever. Harashet. No, there was a Baal or a god in charge of each city. The masculine masculine god. Each city had its own god. In the gods, they would have sister cities, which means the god of this city might like the god of that city, but they have alliances then. And they have two different gods, two different Baals. Now, the Baal would then, of course, mate with Asherah and produce lots of other gods and subsequently that they would worship and such, too. That doesn't matter. The point is that each city had a god, and the god was assigned to cities and towns. And they may not necessarily be the same one. We use the term Baal in our Bibles and print it the god, the fake god. But it was Baal's generic title. It's like saying Lord. It doesn't mean anything. It's which one is it depends who you're talking to. So each city had their own. Oops. Lost that marker. Each city had their own. So that was pretty common. And in the city, the objects, it's behind it, objects had their gods as well. So each city had their molten images or their carvings, their rock formations, whatever they were worshiping to at the same time, was part of their pantheon of deities they would all worship. This is common. Now, mind you, at the time of the Israelites leaving Egypt, Egypt owned these cities already and a whole bunch of others in the Canaanite territory. They had owned them. They crushed them. They honored them. They were inheritors, or sorry, possessors of it for hundreds of years. They owned them. This was all Egyptian territory. Egypt tolerated all these various gods. These are just three examples of cities. Lots of cities in Israel, the Canaanite territory. Examples of gods that they would all worship. Everybody had their own god. Every object had its own god. This is how Egyptian philosophy thought and believed, how all the Canaanites thought and believed. What did our god want to teach them? There's one. The inanimate objects you see don't have a spirit in charge of them. God decides what that inanimate object does. A single God. It's a new concept, new philosophy. We may think, but Abraham knew it was one God. Yes, but that doesn't translate out into generation of generation of generation into Egypt, which is polluted and corrupted to everything else. So the gods don't always stay that way. The philosophy don't stay that way. So we learn from Egyptian philosophy, Egyptian teachings, that objects have gods, so they're asking for gods from Aaron. Lots and lots of gods from Aaron. And of course, he produces one, the calf god, the most dominant one of the Israelites at that time. Now, there are many other cultures who believed and worshipped the calf god, but he was one of the top ones that Aaron was familiar with, as David correctly pointed out, the god of the calf. Now, calf being the one that is the strong one, or whether it's an El, or the great one, the great god, or a great powerful thing. Because calf does all the work that the ox does. Hauling things around. It's a very strong kind of people. That's the idea behind it. So if we understand the idea of what their viewpoint in the world is regarding gods, helps explain what they're asking Aaron to do, and why Aaron does it. Yeah, yes, animal worship is still done today. Things don't change that often. They're still done. Yes, Anne, your question?
It's meant somewhere, I'm not really sure, but doesn't it say that there are principalities over towns, over cities, and
over areas nations? Or regions, yep. There are spirits in charge of, or, now they're all at God's whim, or some argue Satan's whim. We can discuss the details of spiritual stuff. But Satan owns the world, so he's kind of in charge of most of this stuff. But there are principalities over the air, which you will still fight and spiritually be battling continuously. As opposed to inanimate objects. Like, as God points out, the people make idols with eyes and ears and nose and mouth. It can't see, speak, hear, or talk. It should be bowing down to you, not you to it. You're obviously greater. You can see, you can hear, you can speak, you can talk. You do all these things that it can't. It should be on the ground saying, oh, great one. Yeah, because I made it. Very clearly it should. And that's God's point. Hey, it's less than you are. Why are you bowing to it? It should be bowing to you instead. Hence the whole Dagon falling down in the ark. Yes?
Like in India, they have literally the millions thousands. Of
yeah, yeah,
gods.
Yeah, unending.
Every
yeah.
piece is a tree. Every you know, everything has a god to it. If you are a native Indian, in your lifetime, let's say God gives you 100 years, you could not possibly worship and do obeisance to every one of those gods in your own lifetime, but yet right. they have them all.
Yep. It's holy cow. Good answer. Holy cow. Let's move forward. So when Aaron's producing this god, this thing, this idol from the worship, and he, of course, once he sees it, it supposedly pops out. He sees it, and he has this altar. He builds an altar for everybody to worship. And Aaron declares, okay, tomorrow we have, let's have a party. While all this is going on, what's our God doing? When all this is going on, when all Aaron's building this thing, they're all building this calf, they're all getting into party, you have this altar, sacrificing to it, getting into party, what's our God busy doing? Talking to Moses. Does he not realize, hey, something's going on down there? Yeah. Did he say, stop, Moses, before they do this, go fix it? What does he do? He waits. He waits till after they built the god. He waits till after they add the sacrifice to it. He waits till after they've had a big party, after dancing to it and proclaiming how great it is. Then he tells, oh, by the way, Moses, something's gone wrong with the camp. Release me, Moses, and I'll go kill them. Yeah. That seems strange. It should sound strange to us. Does Moses have God by the throat say you can't go away? Is God tied up with a rope so you can't leave Moses? Why didn't Moses say, hey, Moses, or God say, hey, Moses, Aaron's about to do something really, really dumb. Let's go fix it. What's God doing? But does God, yeah, he's having his time with Moses. But why did he interrupted his time when they completed their worship of this thing? He doesn't interrupt before they actually finish it off. Yes, Jeff.
He was letting their iniquity reach its full.
It kept growing. It kept increasing in its capacity. He just waited. Now, he could have told Moses ahead of time, hey, you can stop this. Go fix it. Because they're young. They're not knowledgeable. They're still learning. You can stop this. But he doesn't. And my argument is my personal opinion, Dan Leach's opinion. Yeah, here's my bell going off. I think he was testing Moses, not so much the people. He already knows the people. Of course they're going to do what they're going to do. He's not dumb. He knows where they came from. He knows what their propensity is, what the desire is. That's obvious. What's he doing to Moses? Says, Moses, release me, which means Moses, at your command, I'll go do this, and I'll go kill him off. And what's Moses' response? Yeah.
He was protecting his, keeping God's name holy.
His reputation. God's name holy. Because he said, if you kill them off, everybody's going to disgrace your name. That's one test. He tests Moses. Moses is his prized pupil. Moses is supposed to know as much as anybody else would ever know. He's testing out Moses. Moses, what's your response? What are you going to do about it? How are you going to handle this situation? Yes.
It was also one of his types of Messiah.
Yes, he was. Moses was a messianic.
Messiah's going to have to come back
example.
And do that
yep.
too.
And that's an important part of it. And how Moses handles it is also a messianic way, which we'll discuss that in a minute when we get to the 3,000 dead. So we have Moses dealing with these scenarios of God saying, I'm setting you up, Moses. Here is the easy button now. Hit the button, I'll go kill them all off. What are you going to do about it, Moses? And Moses goes, please, don't kill them, don't kill them. Let me handle this. He goes down the mountain, of course, he sees what they're doing, and Joshua, apparently for the 40 days, has been up on the mountain too, on the side, I'm guessing, maybe halfway up, I don't know, somewhere up on the side, hanging out, not knowing what's happening either, so he's just like, hey, there's a party going on. He says there's a war going on. Moses' response to Joshua is very important. He says, it's not of strength, I don't hear. It's not of a battle. It's not a battle of weakness. It's a sound of distress. It's a strange sound. If you hear a party, you hear, there's a party going on next door. You hear it. Does it sound distressful to you? Not generally. It's still having a good time. There's music, there's dancing, whatever. They're having a good time. But Moses tells Joshua it is a sound of distress. Who is distressed? God is. And who else is distressed as a result because God's distressed? Moses is. It's the sound, it's not that the sound itself is distressed, This other stuff is distressing to God and to Moses because it is an unholy or unrighteous sound. So he's coming down this mountain. He, of course, he sees what's happening. He asks Aaron, what did you do? Verse 21. What did this people do to you? You brought this grievous sin upon it. Now, of course, Aaron gives his spiel about, you know, it popped out. the happenstance. Verse 25. Moses told the people that it was exposed. Pharaoh had exposed them to disgrace among those who rise up against them. What does that mean, exposed? It means you're vulnerable, right? That's it. Exposed to mean you are now vulnerable. What made them vulnerable? And how are they vulnerable now? Doesn't everybody else do the same thing? All of the neighbors worship and praise and love all these various gods? What's the difference? They made an agreement. So, on the agreement, the covenant they made, what is the agreement on God's side? Yeah. I'll protect you. And if I'm now, you're worshiping another god, what's God now doing? Moses say, you were exposed. God moves his hands and says, yep, you are. Hope you enjoy it. Enjoy your exposure. So Moses pointing out, Aaron, you made us exposed. Now here comes the question earlier. How did Aaron retain his, or he gets later, he doesn't have it yet. Well, why did God choose Aaron for the high priest? He did this horrible thing. What's the high priest's job? To cover. That's his job. Day of Atonement is to cover, to erase and to cover up their exposure. Cover up their sins that would end in normal human beings' death. That's a high priest's job, to maintain that covering of God. So when Aaron undoes it, what's Aaron's job now? Darren, as high priest, you are to maintain it. Fix your screw up. Not just you, but every generation after you. Maintain the covering. Hence, Aaron's exposing the people was also used against him, so to speak, and therefore now his job is to continuously cover the people. And all of his descendants thereafter. Not saying this is the only reason he was chosen. The point is that this golden calf gives the reverse of Aaron's job. It's a picture in reverse. Of Aaron, you've screwed up. Now, Aaron, you need to fix it. And Aaron has to fix it from this point on. This idea of exposure. So they've been exposed. The God will no longer protect them, of course, because they're busy doing this various things, these various of revelry or whatever they're doing with this calf. Yes, sir.
Can I just add a little something to the whole Moses and the golden calf thing? It amazes me that, you know, when you look at Stephen's accounting, and when he brings up, when he brings up Moses, he says Moses was educated in all the learning of the Egyptians.
Yes.
And he was a man of power in words and deeds. So, not only was he Egyptian, but obviously he understands, you know, the word for deeds there, you know, is his actions by the Torah. And then it says, when he was approaching the age of 40, he went to visit his brethren. And that's when we know about the murder.
Yep.
So here's this man that. And it's kind of ironic, too, because then he escapes. You know, I mean, he leaves the city almost like a city of refuge before he even knew about a city of refuge, right? But my point to this is that here Moses goes through all this. He obviously loves his brethren, went there, defended them, killed somebody, knew that that was wrong, fled the city, lived out in the desert for 40 years till God comes to him and says, hey, look, you got to go back and get the rest of your family out, leads them out through the Exodus. Which some people say, you know, the curses were a year long, you know, the plagues and such. Right. Who knows? But anyways, I don't think it was one day and overnight. It was probably a quite substantial thing. And then leads them out. He knows these people. They've been in captivity for, 430 years or something close to that. If you think about this country and how, just take Christmas, for example. Supposedly it was outlawed in 1860 or something, and here we are, you know, what's that, 100 and 200 years later, and it's like it's everywhere. Mm-hmm. So think about them being under the rule of the Egyptians with these cows and this cow gods and how those people worshipped it, believed it, And they see this. So Moses takes his people out into the desert, you know, right off their complaining. He knows they're unhappy. They don't understand what's going on. They weren't talking to God.
Right.
Moses knows what's going on and what's in store for him. And then this goes on where they're like, hey, we'll just go back to the only thing we know.
Yeah,
which is this golden calf thing. And when Moses comes down from the mountain after he talks to God, and God's like, you know, I'm just going to kill them all. He's like, well, just kill me too. I mean, this is my family. You know, all this for nothing. You know, you're going to prove the Egyptians right that you brought us out here to kill us. And then he comes down with these tablets, you know, that him and God, that God wrote out in his words on this stone tablet to go down and teach these people. And then the chaos that's going on. And here's the golden calf again, almost like they're back in Egypt. I mean, you have to feel for them. I mean, what a horrible thing. I mean, what shock and awe come upon him, you know, to throw the tablets down and break them. And he's just like, you know, and then to come of the heart and go back up to the mountain and say, you know, let me make atonement for my people. To me, is just a whole amazing story.
It's a profound thing about Moses.
Many very, very layers profound. To that onion.
Yep. Yeah. There's a lot about Moses' life the Bible doesn't record, but a lot of things which he did and just his life in general. A very profound man. Very humble man, but as Stephen would have known the same stories that most people of his day knew about Moses' early life, and whether right or wrong doesn't matter. The point is that it teaches that Moses was knowledgeable not just in Israelite ways, but Egyptian ways too, in lots and lots of things. A very, very wise individual. He went through an awful lot. He was willing to go through an awful lot. And he understood something about God, which I want to bring your attention to why I'm doing go with this spiel about here, is that God did something with Moses' address. God reconsidered. He reconsidered. Which means he changed his mind. Now God says, I don't change. He tells us that. I never change. But he changed when Moses addressed him. So what does that mean then? Both statements can't be true. One must be misunderstood. So when God reconsidered with Moses' address, based on what Moses was saying, which was correct, the same as Moses said, did God truly reconsider or change his mind? Now, I bring that up because, honestly, he really didn't. Everybody still dies later. But at that time, he gave the impression that God reconsidered, I will not do by killing off these people who you correctly point out, are just doing what they know. They don't know anything else yet. They're still learning. They're still basing their understanding of what God is still teaching them. They're still infancy. You don't strike an infant for doing anything foolish when there's no knowledge. That would make no sense. And God's not doing so either. But his testing, to my mind, his testing with Moses is very unique in how he's handling Moses. He's teaching Moses. Moses already knows some, but Moses learns something deeper about God. About the nature of when something is critical, how to deal with it, how to handle forgiveness in a way that is contrary to the explicit words already given to him. I say contracts, we already have, but Exodus 22, you kill everybody who worships another god. Across the board, no questions asked. Well, in this case, Moses only kills 3,000 people. Same debate from hundreds of thousands to in the tens of thousands. We don't really know. But they were all there, the people, whatever that means, the large numbers of them, whatever they were. He kills 3,000 of them, not all of them. So we're learning things about Moses and about God, that God commanded, hey, when this happens, you kill. There is no, oh, it's okay, pat you on the back. No. Right. And we're learning this thing about Moses and his knowledge and his wisdom that isn't well explained in just the text alone. We understand what kind of Messiah is this Moses? What kind of person is he? What knowledge does he have? And how is he using God's knowledge and God's wisdom in order to facilitate saving these either tens or hundreds of thousands of people? It could be easy to mark. Yeah. Oh, okay, make it quick.
Real quick. I'm sorry. That same thing that we were talking about, you know, with the whole you know, you made a promise with Abraham, you know, to make his descendants great. Well, he could have done the same thing with Moses.
Right.
He could have killed them all.
Yep.
And Moses' descendants would have become the sands of the sea.
Yep.
And he still would have kept his promise.
Yep. Yep.
So it's not like any promise would have been broken.
Right. God wasn't breaking a promise. Sorry, you're coming.
You said his nature never changes, and I just want to, or God never changes, Jehovah never changes. And he's always been merciful. And that just shows that, you know, the.
That's
the God
the part,
of the Old Testament is still merciful. You know, he was able, based on, you know, the human heart, to change his mind and show mercy, because the wages of sin are death.
That's how. That's when God shows, it's loosely himself to Moses, the backside, all the stuff that's rattled off as his title, you know, merciful thousands. That's who he is. And yet that's why he doesn't change, because it's already within inside of his character to do that. But how do we impart this forgiveness concept? And even though somebody may boil our blood in anger what they're doing, to ourselves. Like for a friend. Yeah. So if we have a scenario where Moses is saying, okay, God, you are all ultimately forgiving, doing everything this great stuff, and what you've done in kindness to thousands of generations, how do we as people imitate God? Just forgive everything? No, God doesn't forgive everything. He says he doesn't forget everything. He makes it account. So, there's still the account still there, but how do we handle, how do we act or be like him in his nature? Of both, there's a fixed law, it's always this way, but there's a method or a scenario which you can get around your screw-ups. And how do we impart that to ourselves, and then how do we treat other people in that way? We're learning by Moses' character, his messianic figure, Messiah does the same thing. How to facilitate God's understanding, God's wisdom, and use it. And not in a negative sense, but a positive sense, to help people. Back to our earlier comment about spiritual work. Yes, Deborah.
Well, it shows in the New Testament that though he took 3,000, in the New Testament shows he saved 3,000.
Right. I think somebody had asked that about that as well. Acts, yes.
So that shows you the nature of, that shows you who he is, though he can take, he can bring back again. You know what I mean? He could take our lives, we may die, but we will be in the new kingdom. If he chose us to live with him.
That's the idea behind it. Yep. Other hands up. Go ahead, Dan.
I didn't get all the reading. I didn't get to hear it. Now, what about her? Was there something about her in this?
He was the grandfather of Aholiab, I think, the artist.
Right. They had he helped.
But hold Moses' arms up. Yep, right. That man.
And did the people actually murder him on the way when Moses was on his way back up the mountain or down the mountain?
That is a tradition. I cannot specify that as true. I can't say it's true. The reason it's a tradition is it's also a tradition that he is the husband of Miriam. That's also a tradition. I don't know if it's true or not. Right, exactly. Because they don't even know. Exactly. Because Miriam's from Levi and he's from Judah. We have no knowledge. It's just a tradition and what their philosophies are, because the nature of traditions are not evil, but don't use them as your standing point of ground, because if they crumble, you'll crumble too. It's nature of traditions. Yes, Larry.
I was just thinking, I think it's James points out that the prayer of a righteous man will cover many sins. Mm-hmm. And there's like three that are shown to kind of bargain with God about for the lives of other people. And that was Abraham, Moses, and probably Messiah. I mean, because he's the one that stands in our way.
For other people. Yeah, there's at least some argue Job, but that's for his children. I don't know if that really works. It's iffy, hard to say. Daniel may have too. That's really also iffy, because it's hard to how he was using. Yeah, it's strange. There aren't that many. The point is, there aren't that many righteous men who did that or even could do it or righteous enough to make it a value. There aren't that many. That's the idea. Yep, same degree. Okay, let's move. I'm going to end this real quick because we have to go to our Purim play. Let's see here. I want to rattle off to point a few things to you. The tail end of chapter 32. Which he points out that God's going to say, I'll send my angel before you to go before you. This is verse 34. Oh, 33 and 34. By the way, so Moses, all right, recap a little bit. Moses goes off, he kills 3,000 people, he comes back. That did not fix the problem. Because what's the problem with humans when we say, oh, well, all people did something wrong, let's go fix them and punish them? You're going to miss something. You're going to punish the wrong person or not enough of people. You're never going to get it right. What's God then do as his fix for Moses' incomplete address? Verse 34, or 33, I'm sorry. Whoever is sinning against me, I shall erase him from my book. Now go to the people elsewhere I've told you, and my hold my angel before you, and then they'll come. And on the day that I make my account, I shall bring their sin to account against them. Lord, struck the people with a plague because they had made the calf that Aaron had made. So Moses only addressed the 3,000 people. There could have been tens or hundreds of thousands of people all involved in this. We don't know. What's God doing? He addresses each one. Now, a year ago or something like that, somebody had asked me, what's the difference between when it says here, punished or killed versus cut off? The Torah will use that a couple times. This person's killed for the sin or they're cut off. The cut off is God doing it. Killed is you doing it. You don't know whatever he's doing. So sometimes you make it the wrong person or make a mistake. But God knows even what's inside the person. He's what cuts them off the blessings. He says, hey, I'm severing this person off. You may not know it, but he does. So God's doing his cutting off of the individual he's plaguing, or individuals he's plaguing, however they are, and it doesn't make a difference. So he's addressing the God that Moses missed. But Moses learned and showed something to all of us by his nature of how he handled the situation. I'm going to end real quick with a few details. One, the angel that he's pouring out will go before you. God already tells us in Acts 23 that angel cannot forgive sins. So don't screw up in front of this angel. As an angel, Lord, he says in Acts 23, it says, the angel cannot forgive because my name is with him. He cannot forgive your sins. So don't sin. Don't. My angel is before you. You screw up. He has one instruction. You die. Move on, because he's not for you, nor is he against you. He's for God only. You're just a tag along. So don't screw up in front of God's angel. It's important. And then also end with last timing discussion here. A few of the verses says that Moses spoke to God face to face as a man speaks to a friend. It's recorded in verse 11 of, I think it's 34, I think it is. Or maybe 33, verse 11. The term face there, panim, be careful when we use this term. Well, but Moses then saw God. No, Moses didn't see God. The term panim, pani, panai, they're all different pronunciations for different things, is also the same word used for presence, for God's presence. That he's in front of, not physically looking like I can see your eyeballs, but rather I'm in front of you to speak. Not they have to physically see the individual, but presence used. God uses it himself in verse 11 and 12. He says my face, my presence, pana, versus my face, panim. They're the same word is transferred as face. It doesn't mean face, it means his existence is in front of you or at your location. Hence, when Moses goes to tents, the cloud comes down. And so he's in the presence of God while God's speaking. So two men can speak to their face-to-face, in their faces, or in the same presence of each other. That's the idea of the concept of panim. So it's not literally only face, it's presence of someone as well. So Moses didn't have to see God's face to speak to him. He can be in God's presence and speak to him, and still face-to-face, because you're in God's presence. Make sense? So try to confuse the terms. Sometimes you get them confusing, and that Moses saw God. He didn't. Not his face. Didn't see that one. Some people believe a lot of different things, so I won't tell you what we all believe, because each person has their own opinion regarding what presence that meant and how that panned out or how that played out. Some people perceive one thing, while some perceive a different thing, and unfortunately, that debate is very lengthy. And not worth a discussion here and now. any questions or comments? We're going to end this because we have a Purim play to do. Let's conclude with prayer real quick and we'll go into our Purim. Almighty God, our great Heavenly Father, thank you for this Shabbat day of rest, for teaching us and showing us what is good and right. Help us, Father, to be good servants to you, to follow you as best we can. We trust you and ask your blessing on the rest of our Shabbat and the rest of our Purim play we're doing this afternoon. May you keep us safe, Father. May you teach us well. May we serve you well. We praise you in the name of your Son, Yeshua HaMashiach. Amen. Take a few minute break when we get ourselves up for a Purim.
I need volunteers for my pre-play skit.